Welcome to this lecture. Eventually the subway arrived, but so I wonder why I got up early. It's incredible. So what did we do yesterday? So yesterday we kind of collected or kind of put together the bits and pieces which we have constructed in the last weeks. And once again, very briefly, originally the goal was to remove the repeated computations, say in address expressions. So that was the available expressions. In order to make it work, we kind of introduced auxiliary variables for receiving the values of these expressions. So then, but that we did blindly, and that meant that we introduced spurious, if you like, spurious variables, superfluous variables, which then led to extra and to new inefficiencies, namely these variable assignments. But then we had this idea that we kind of keep track of where the values of expressions may move to, and by that could remove these variable assignments. But we removed it in two steps. We kind of short-circuited these variable assignments, and by that succeeded in marking certain variables as dead. So this was this here, for example, this B turned out to be dead, and this A2 turned out to be dead, and this A1 also turned out to be dead. And then we had this fantastic optimization which removes assignments to dead variables, and by that ultimately we got rid of the superfluous assignments. Yeah, so in that sense, several transformations and analyses kind of cooperated in ultimately improving the code. And so in that sense, this is, by that you kind of learn one golden rule of program optimization, and this golden rule says that there is no silver bullet. There is no single optimization which does all the things for you. You have to do many things, to try many things, and then hope that all your optimizations cooperate to improve the code. So bore you with such anecdotes, but so in some areas, like when they introduce new data structures, these BDD data structures, for example, or certain model checking algorithms, then it is a conference contribution if you can say, I have a new algorithm which provided me a speed up of a factor of 10, or a factor of 5, or a factor of 2. And in fact, you cannot hope for here, because there are already a huge amount of optimization. So if you have already a decent compiler, then you have already a lot of such optimizing transformations. And now you come with a new one, and this only adds to a bunch of other optimizations. So if you, in the end, get a speed up of the resulting programs by 2%, then it is an incredibly good optimization which you have achieved. So that makes in that sense, here we have to, but still we have to provide all these optimizations, because in some cases this one works and in other cases the other one works, and only jointly you get an incredible speed up, but only an incredible speed up with respect to the original unoptimized program, but not with respect to the already existing optimizations. So now let us go for another very important. Are there questions to that kind of thing? Now comes another, we will proceed to, so, and maybe you have observed here, we have kind of provided a lot of optimizations, but the pattern was always, very similar. Do an analysis. And how to do the analysis, we have seen now three examples which were also quite similar, and then exploit the information to modify, locally modify the program. And for these analyses, they were all similar, but if you look, they were all also all different. So the first one was a forward analysis, the next one was a backward analysis, and the third one was a forward analysis, but with a more complicated domain. So we did not only have just sets and intersection and union or so, but we had more complicated domains. So in that sense, you see that it's not all the same. So for a particular analysis, you have to carefully think what is the information you want to compute and how to formalize it with a complete lattice and how to realize the transformations corresponding to the different to the various control flow edges. So that makes so since you have there a design space and you have to think and be creative, so this makes it an interesting topic. Now comes another optimization, which is called constant propagation, constant propagation, so that might be the analysis. Constant folding sometimes is called the transformation. And so what is the idea here? So the idea here is, again, a philosophical one which tries for improving code. So improving code, how can we speed up program execution? Okay, by removing computations. So that is, so if we do have to do less computation, then the program execution might be faster. So that is kind of one of our guiding ideas. Now, if there's computation replicated, we might kind of remove it. If it is superfluous, because it's assignment to that variable, we might remove it. And there's a third reason under which a third possibility remove a computation, namely to shift it. To shift it just from runtime to compile time. So this does not mean that the computation is redundant or you can go without it, but you do it simply at another point in time. So, and it also means if you do it at compile time, you do it once. And so that means at runtime, hopefully your program runs several times, then you will not pay for it anymore. So that is this idea of constant propagation, execute code at compile time. So here's an example. So here we have this variable x here. In this program, it is set to 7, and then it is tested for greater or to 0. And if this is the case, then some code is executed; otherwise, nothing is executed. Okay. Now, what do we see? Now we clearly see. Okay, x is 7, so if I test x for greater of 0, then I know 7 is greater than 0, so definitely the test will be true. So therefore I know m will be written to b will be written to m of a. And so that means that the variable x together with the testing of x can be completely removed. And instead, we execute the then part of the if then else. Now, again, when I come up with such a possibility of an optimization, you immediately will agree with me that this improves the code. But again, you will ask, or you might ask, who? What code is this? Will we ever write such stupid code? And now the question is for you again. I ask you, will you ever write such stupid code?
Yourself, but maybe you're using macros or something. generate such expressions eventually?
One could use if one has macros, yes, but sometimes. So is it sometimes the case that you write that you introduce a variable and give it an explicit value like 7? Does this occur in your code?
Hmm? In for loops, you must initialize it with 0, and sometimes you also have the upper bound that's also known before.
This is true. So you, if you have a for loop, you initialize the I with, say, 0. But then in the course of program execution, I will change its value. So I will be incremented, so this 0 will not survive, but will be replaced with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So in that sense, there is a constant assignment, yes, but it is in some sense the I would not be a program constant. So I can tell you that for the introductory course in informatics, I provided some kind of made some little experiments also with a graphical user interface of Java, and then I made pictures from boxes and such things, and then I kind of had to repeatedly used boxes of the same sizes, and so I looked at the. So what could I do? So I could hard code the height and width of these boxes, and then look at it and see, oh no, this looks ugly. I have to change, and then I have to change in 20 places this constants. And the alternative is kind of to write at one place in my program all these kind of scaling factors, widths and height and all that stuff, and then use that the names symbolically all over the code. And then when I see, oh no, it looks ugly, I have to change the height of my boxes, I change it in one place, and then it is changed everywhere, consistently. So in that sense, it is, for certain tasks, it is good practice to use named constants instead of the constants explicitly. Because also the named constant is kind of a comment to a number. And when you read your code, you see a number, and now you have to recall, what does this 2 mean here? And a 2 is a 2 is a 2. Yes, so it's just a number. But if it's the height of your box, then it's also the value 2, yes, but it's the height of your box. And in other places, there will not occur the 2, but the height of the box. And in that sense, it is good programming style to introduce for certain repeatedly occurring constants names. So that is one use of... also pi, you would not write to write the period of pi into your code. You use a name for it. Typically, you do not even have to write the assignment pi equals, I don't know what kind of sequence of numbers, digits, but it is provided by, I guess, math library or so, whatever you use. There is a constant pi, and that has built in. So the library is provided for you. You do not even have to look it up. Therefore, there are constants in that sense are ubiquitous. And the other thing is, at least there is a good style. I was told by when the Google people, we had a talk from one of the Chrome developers. They have thousands of features, and thousands of programmers work in parallel on thousands of features. And how do they deal with it? They introduce switches. And usually these switches are by default 0, so therefore the feature is switched off. But when they do the development for their development branch, they switch it to 1. And then it is functionality becomes activated by such a test. And so it's a 1. So it tests a 1, whether it's 1 or not, and then they do some code. And if it's so the code contains a constant, and the constant is used to as a flag to activate code or to deactivate code. The same is something like debug mode. You might have a switch debug mode, and then certain tests outputs are produced. And if you set that single variable to zero, then the debug mode is switched off, and you get production code. And now but then if you use that kind of pattern, you would not like to be punished for that flag. And in fact, this optimization will then simply, depending on the flag, remove that part of the code which is not activated and leave that which is activated. So therefore, having constants in your code which and tests of these constants is not something which is stupid, but it is part of certain coding styles or design patterns. So therefore, it's a useful thing to have if you can trust your compiler to do that kind of propagation. And now, so the philosophical idea to take a... So you can generalize it. This constant thing is one thing, and we will only look at that. But I may remind you that there is the philosophical point of taking a program, searching for parts which can be evaluated at compile time, and pre-processing the program so that the compile time parts are evaluated first. This general principle has been investigated for some years, for several years, and one of the key players in that business was Neil Jones from Deku. He's now long emerited and I don't know how active he still is, but he was one of the key researchers in that area, which is called partial evaluation. And these people in partial evaluation even took the radical point of view that a compiler itself is something like a partial evaluation of an interpreter. An interpreter takes a program and an input and produces the output. Now you can say, if I partially apply the interpreter to the program alone, no input, only the program, then I have something which I might partially evaluate already. And the result of that partial evaluation is a residual program which could be done, which is in essence that what a compiler returns. So a compiler is performs a partial evaluation of an interpreter with respect to a program. So that was their idea, and they tried to come up with automatic tools for partial evaluation which are as good as standard compilers, which never worked, but at least was a smart idea. Okay. So now what is the... Now I have set the challenge. Now we have to design an analysis and a transformation. So the transformation is clear. If I know that X has the value 7, then everywhere where the 7 occurs, I can replace it with 7. And if there's a condition which I can evaluate by all that static information, then I replace it with a knob edge. So that's the idea. So the transformation is in some sense not difficult. It is along the lines how we do our transformations. But the interesting point is, or perhaps an interesting point is, how do we obtain the information whether a variable X at some program point has always a definite value whenever I reach that program point? Yeah. And clearly, if we are able to evaluate conditions at runtime, we might find out that certain parts of the code are not reachable at all, because they are reached only along paths traversing certain conditions, which always are false. And then that would allow us to identify parts of the code which are not reachable at all. And these we also would like to remove. So now how do we do it? So we have to track the values of variables. So now what? How do we model the values of variables? Okay, so in our toy language, variables only take values in the positive or negative integers. We even were a little bit careless with the decision whether or not there is the range of integers is finite or whether it is unbounded integers. So for simplicity, we assumed, for simplicity of the semantics, we assumed that we have unbounded integers. So there is no max int and no min int. But still, variables can only take integers. And even addresses were integers, non-negative integers. And we had nothing else. So that was a crude simplification of that, what happens in the real world. But it is in our, for our toy language. We might go with that. So then, okay, so we somehow, so we have to track whether a variable has a value. Or in some cases, we might not know. And not knowing means that it could have several values. So, for example, think of this index I of a for loop. So before the loop, we know after setting I to zero that it has the value zero. But when we go into the body of the loop and iterate and visit the nodes in the body several times, we will find, oh, I might be zero or one or two or something. So in that sense, we would kind of record the fact that we do not, that I could have possibly multiple values, and that we indicate by such a top element. Okay, and then on this natural integers, together with this top element, we use just the ordering, which says, okay, integers have are mutually incomparable, and top is larger. And why is top? Why do we put top on top of it? Well, okay, the name indicates it, but this extra element, this unknown value, why do we put it on top of it? It is because it says we have no information, so that means it we know less, and knowing less conceptually means that values get larger, and therefore this unknown value is on top of the other ones. So please observe that this is not a complete lattice, so the bottom element is missing. But then what these are just the values of individual variables. At a particular program point, we do not have just one variable, but all variables. So therefore, the information about values of variables therefore takes the form of an assignment of program variables to their potential values. So that is, X gets the value 5, Y gets the value top. That would be such an description of our information on variables at the program point. Yeah. So I write it down so you can see it. It could be X is mapped to 5 and Y is mapped to top. So that would indicate we know the value of X. We do not know the value of Y. Okay? Now, and the if you have two such mappings, then the ordering is one mapping is larger than the other if it is so for each component. So that is what I kind of try to indicate here. And then there is the possibility that the program point is not reached at all. And then if it is not reached, we have no information about, so we need not say, we cannot say anything about any of the axes. We could, this does not mean that every variable is mapped to top. Because if it were mapped to top, then it would mean that it is simply an unknown value, but we reach it. So we want to distinguish between unknown values and a not reachable program point. So therefore we introduce a new value now, this bottom element. But this is kind of outside. If you like, that is, the bottom element is here. So it is below such a value. Yeah, it says, I cannot reach it at all. This is the best information for us from a program optimization point of view. the best information we can get is a broken point is not reachable at all, because then we can remove it. The next best is we reach the broken point, but the variables have definite values. And the next and the worst state is we do not know whether we may reach the broken point, and every variable may have any value. So every variable is mapped to top. That is the largest element in our this set D. And this set D with this ordering then is a complete lattice. Oop. Yeah. This is a complete lattice, and So how can we prove it? Well, we take a set of such maps and try to find out what is a set of such elements of D, and try to find out whether we can come up with the least upper bound. But so if the set is empty or only contains this bottom element, then the least upper bound is just this bottom element, and otherwise we may have a set X of a subset X of D, and this bottom element is not inside it, or if it were, we simply throw it away because it's the least element, so it's less than anything else anyway. And so if that is the case, then this, now if you have such a set X, and then it is a set of assignments of variables to values, and then the least upper bound is obtained. Well, if that is not empty, if that is not empty, then the least upper bound is obtained by simply by a function which maps every element x to the least upper bound of the values of the elements in x, in the capital X for this little x. And since since this x is not empty, we have to compute a non-empty least upper bound here, and that is there is at least one number there, or several numbers in top. And if there's only one number in this set, then this is the least upper bound is this number. Otherwise, we will return top. So therefore, the least upper we can construct such a least upper bound function D, and such a function D, and it is indeed the least upper bound. So that can also be verified. Okay. Now we have so once again, I may write down 5y top if you take the least upper bound with x 7, y 1. What is the result? What do we get for x? The least upper bound of 5 and 7. Okay, so this is top. And then for y, what value do we get for y? The least upper bound of 1 and top. This is also top. Okay, so that is, you see here, it's the least upper bound of these two assignments is very boring, but that is in some sense, often if you do constant propagation, you will find that you find out nothing. So you have to live with it. Only for some variables and for some few variables, you will be able to find a non-top value. So now let us make a little bit of a change. So if here that 7 would be a 5, then we would have for the x the least upper bound of 5 and 5, and that is 5. So in this particular case, where all the assignments agree in one variable, only then you can get this value is preserved. In all other cases, you obtain top. Okay? So this kind of settles the ordering for this constant propagation. So I wrote down the formalities, but the example immediately shows what we would like to have here. Is there a question? Okay, so now, now we know what kind of values we want to have for every program point, namely such kind of functions, assigning variables to information about the value of the variable. Now, or bottom, if the program point is not reachable. Now we have to come up with how this information is changed when we traverse a control flow edge, or how it is affected by the action performed at the edge. So now, we want to know what is the action of the edge to the program state in some sense, because that is the information which we track. The program state, perhaps a little bit extended, so a little bit parts of it, because for some variables we only have top, but for the others it's just the program state, and it's the state of the variables, if you like. For the memory, this constant propagation makes no attempts to find something else. So the memory is somehow ignored. So what should the transformation for a program point, for a control flow, what should it do? Somehow it should do what the concrete semantics does. At least the best what we can do if we know only the values of some variables. So that is this lab star. So that should be the transformation, which is from D to D, which somehow models the concrete semantics of the program. And in particular, so this our complete lattice D contains this particular element bottom. And that is the first choice which we have to do. What happens if we apply, if we traverse the edge and the value at the start point of the edge is bottom? What should be the result? And here, I have a new version of the slides where there is no these marks, because some students have complained about these stupid marks. I have removed them. Now what happens if we apply? If we have an unreachable program point and we perform an action, what should be the result? So now I claim the result should be again an unreachable program point, because from something which you cannot reach, you cannot reach something else. So therefore, bottom should be preserved by all these transformations. So that is the first thing. And therefore, for all the transformations, we only have to consider the case where we have a value which is different from bottom, and then it is such a variable assignment, and now we have to define what is the result when we apply the transformation of the edge to a variable assignment. Okay, so that is now the thing which we have to do. And in order to do so, I will consider consider an auxiliary problem first. And the auxiliary problem is that inside of our actions by which we label control flow edges, there occur expressions. So for assignments, you have expressions for memory reads, for memory writes, for all that, for conditions. You all have expressions. And so the key step in finding out what's going on in the concrete semantics, in the small step semantics which we have given our language, is we stated, okay, if I have an expression and I have a program state, then I can tell you what is the result of the expression. And now if we want to do this constant propagation, it's the same thing. So we have information about X and Y. And now is X here is an expression X plus Y. In some cases, we might be even able to determine the value of X plus Y. And that is what we... for some expressions, we will not be able to determine the value, and then we return the value top for that expression. So now how do we find out immediately an example. So x plus y. So this is our expression. And we want to know what is the value of it. And we want to know it for such an assignment. Yeah. So now in this case, for that expression and this argument, we immediately see that we will not be able to determine the value of x plus y. Why? Because y has the value top. And so intuitively this means it can have any value, and 5 plus any value, this is any value. Yeah, so the result of that is top. Now, this kind of reasoning, ad hoc reasoning, if you like, we can do very easily for this expression and this assignment to variables. Now, how can we do it in a systematic way? And doing it in a systematic way is not very difficult. We simply have to modify the definition of the plus. So the plus operator takes two numbers and adds them. Okay, but now the modification is that one of the numbers might also be top. So we modify the definition of the plus, so it takes care of the top. So it means simply if one of the arguments is top, then the result is top. Okay? And then, with this modified operator, we can do expression evaluation as before, because that would propagate the top to all sub-expressions which are top, which we don't know. Yeah, so that's the idea. So we replace the operators which we have in our concrete semantics. This box is an arbitrary such operator by an abstract version of it. So in the abstract version, here would be one possibility to define it, or for constant propagation, we simply say, okay, the result is top if one of the arguments is top, otherwise we use the concrete operator. Okay, and then we use these new extended operators to define an extended form of expression evaluation, which is the same as before, only that now these top values are taken care of. Since we simply replace the original operators by the new operators. Okay, so that means when we, for constants, it would simply return the constants, and if we have an operator application, then we evaluate the arguments and then apply this new operator here in the middle. Okay? And the same for unary negation, for example. So here is another example where we can kind of quite mechanically... I provide these definitions in order to have a mechanical thing which I can easily implement. Yeah, because expression evaluation, I guess this is an exercise which you have implemented many times, and then when there was a plus in the syntax, you used the plus operator. But now you would use this plus sharp operator, and that would give you the abstract evaluation. So here is again an example. So our information about the program state is this: x is 2, y is unknown. And then if you have x plus 7, then technically, well, we know immediately 2 is known. X has the value 2, so the result should be now 9. We know it, but how would we kind of mechanically obtain it? We would recursively first determine the value of x, yes, that would be the value 2. We would determine the value of 7, that is the value 7, and then use this operator plus sharp to combine these values to the value 9. So that's not surprising. And now let's take the same thing for x minus y. Y is unknown. So mechanically, we evaluate the sub-expressions. for x we obtain 2, for y we obtain top, because that's the information provided for y by d. And then we apply, and then there we apply the operator corresponding to the minus, which is this minus sharp, to these two values. And this minus sharp was defined if one of the top element, if one of the arguments is top, then the result is top, and therefore the result is top. Okay, so it's not so it's that what we now we are able, we can use, we can evaluate all expressions in right hand sides with respect to the information which we have provided by our D. Yeah, and that allows us now to define the transformations in the non-bottom case. So, okay, so let's see how, let us go step by step how we do it. And again, the definitions here are not made for to be as surprising, but to be as natural as possible, and just to model what's going on in the concrete semantics, which we try to approximate as good as we can with the little information we have. So this means if we have a no-op, then information does not change about the state. The state does not change, therefore the D does not change. Now let us see at an assignment. So what is it? So here we have, that is the first case where we have an expression E on the right hand side. So the expression E we can evaluate by our super duper method, giving us top or a value. And then we update the X in our D with that value. So that's how we did. We did the same thing for in the concrete semantics, only that there was no top. And we always were able to determine the value. So, but otherwise, the form here is the same. Now, for memory read, that is very easy. There is an expression. We might evaluate it. But since we do not keep track of the value in memory, what can we say? The only thing what we can say is, whenever we look up a value in memory, it could be anything. So therefore we return top. And now here in that, if we write to memory, okay, we evaluate expressions, but the values of the variables do not change. So perhaps this last line could be improved. How could it be improved? You could track memory locations, yes, but if we kind of ignore memory locations, the last line could still be improved. But we could track something which we have not tracked and I deliberately ignore, but which we should not ignore, which are runtime errors. We could say, so if E1 definitely is a negative value, or if it is a negative value, so it's an illegal address, then we could say this would be gives a memory error, so the value afterwards is bottom. Yeah, or we could say the thing explodes, it's top or something, I don't know. So we could say it's that should not be possible. And the other thing is if there's a division by zero error, that's the same thing. So we could kind of use memory errors, if we have constant. That means that there will always be a memory or a runtime error here. And then the question is, what should the compiler do if a memory error occurs? That's again something which then is debatable, what the compiler should do if it detects a runtime error. Should it produce the runtime error because it's, if it is perhaps, maybe it's an exception which is an exception which is handled by the program, so then the runtime error should stay Or should it say, okay, then the program is illegal or so, and then discard the whole program? I don't know. So there are many choices what one could do. Here, we simply do nothing, which might be okay or might be problematic. Now, but then, so that were the easy cases. Now comes another case. Now come the guards. And why are the guards special? The guards allow... there we can use the information provided by D to find out that the guard is always wrong, is always false, or will always fail. I must say it like that. The guard will always fail. And that means that the program point afterwards is not reachable. So that is, and therefore we have to, that we, how can we, when can we say, so the question is, when can we say that the program point following this guard is not reachable? Okay, so then not reachable means that the value of E definitely must be zero. And that it not possibly must be zero, but definitely must be zero. Under all circumstances, the value is zero, then this guard is never this road is never taken. So that means if we evaluate the expression E and find out that it is an expression, and it could be if there's, for example, X compared with Y, X is 5, Y is 0, then we can definitely say what is the result. And if it is 0, then we know that it's definitely not taken. In all other cases, we, if, for example, if the evaluation of the condition is top, then it could be 1, it could be 0. So therefore we cannot say whether it is taken or not, and then we must assume for to be on the safe side that it may be taken. So therefore we do nothing. We just return the D. Okay? And the same for the negative expression E. In that case, for the negative expression E, how is it there? So we might evaluate the E. If the E possibly has the value 0, so it might be 0 or it might be top. In these cases, the result should be D. If it is 5 or 6 or 7 or minus 42, then we definitely know that this guard will not be taken. So if it's a definite value but different from 0, then we know it will not be taken, and this is the situation when we return bottom. Okay? So, once again, we exploit the information as much as we can to find out whether we definitely can rule out that the guard is, will ever be taken. Okay? So now let us look at our super-duper example. At program start, what do we have here? At program start, all variables are have some value which we don't know. So it's not so that they are have no value. We assume that they have an unknown value.
Again, to these conditions, we only track currently one constant expression per variable. So we assign every variable a constant expression if we can compute it. So why do we regard the possibility for the condition that there are that it can take the variables the value zero?
Here?
For
the negative value, so
yeah, actually,
no, we track all variables, not just one variable.
Okay, yeah, but it's only dependent on this relation of expression E. So actually,
no. So let us assume the condition. So let us make a concrete example. We have the expression X greater than zero, and the value D is X equal to top. Yeah, so there are other variables which I ignore for the moment, but it contains the information that I know nothing about X. What can I say? I may reach the program point in the positive or in the negative. So I have to, for the, to be on the safe side, I cannot return I cannot return bottom, I have to return D. And that is, in this case, the abstract value. Now let me write it like that. Of the D is top. And that means zero is less or equal to top. Therefore, the negative guard will return not bottom, so we may pass this. And also the positive guard may return D because it is not definitely zero. And now let us just, for sanity, see what happens if we then replace that here with the value 5. No, let's make it black. 5. So then x 5 is greater than 0, so the result, therefore, is 1. Now let's see what the positive thing would mean. That means, so the bottom case, 0 is the value, no, the value is 1, so that it's not 0, so therefore the positive guard will fire and we will have D. And the negative 1, so we find, okay, it is not the case that 0 is less or equal to 1 in this ordering which we consider, where they are different variables. Distinct variables are incomparable and only comparable to top. So therefore, we would go to bottom. And now let us again, so just for to make all the cases, to see all the cases, if we put in minus here, then the expression will evaluate to 0. The x greater than 0 will evaluate to 0, because it's not the case that minus 5 is greater than 0. Now let us look at the positive e. For the positive E, we find, okay, yes, the evaluation of the expression returns zero, therefore it is bottom. We will not go that. And for the negative one, we find, oh yes, zero is less or equal to the value, and therefore we will have D. So that's all the cases. Is there any question more about it? Now, at start point, again, that is debate, a little bit of a debate. What is the value of the variables at program start? We could assume some kind of auto-initialization that at program start, every variable has value zero. We could use that. Then we should use such a D0 for the program start. Or we could take the point of view that at program start, all variables are uninitialized, and that means they have any value, and that would give them the value top. So here, for the moment, we assume simply that they are top, they are unknown. So that is, so this value then corresponds to what we have at program point 1. Now at program point 2, we see that there was an... We see what's going on. Then at program point 2, there's this assignment of 7 to x. So the 7 can be evaluated, giving the value 7, and this is assigned. So therefore, we have that value at program point 2. And then the positive edge, x greater than, in this, with respect to that assignment, x greater than 0 evaluates to 1. Therefore, the guard is definitely taken. And we have the same x maps to 7 at program point 3. Program point 4 has the same because value is not changed by the writing to memory. And now, what is the value of program point 5? So this negative guard is not taken. So it will never succeed because at program with the assignment which we have at program point 2, we found out that there x is always greater than 0. Therefore, here, this guard returns bottom. And therefore, for program point 5, we have to take the least upper bound of the bottom from the left and the x maps to 7 to the right. And bottom, least upper bound to something else gives something else. So therefore, This is the value for 5. Okay? Okay, and then now we have the abstract effects for an edge. We can compose them again to paths. We can define the merge over all paths, and we can define the least fixed point solution of a constraint system. So we can simply apply our machinery. Now again, so now since here the transformations which we have at control flow edges are quite complicated, one might wonder, how can we prove that what happens at the that all the things which we compute, that they are correct? And here helps something which kind of was more or less in parallel to that what Kildall did. That was the world, but while Kildall was the American style compiler technology, that was the French style, and that is by, it was the PhD. So Kildall's work with that distributive functions, and so that was his PhD thesis, and abstract interpretation, this is Patrick's PhD thesis. He is, I think, for 1 or 2 years now, he's also out of, no longer, he was at ENS Paris, and now he's no longer there, and he's retired and has moved to New York. So now he, as a senior professor, he is at least for some years, as far as I know, currently still working at New York State University. And he enjoys living in New York. So that's it's amazing. So I would never have guessed that a person voluntarily gives up Paris for some other city, but I guess New York is a decent alternative. Okay, so by the way, so Couseau, the other Couseau here is Radia Couseau, that is his wife, or has been his wife. She died, I guess, last year. So it's a bit sad. Okay, so now what is so abstract? So he came up with abstract interpretation, and one must say, perhaps one more gossip in that direction, or a kind of philosophical background. The idea of the Couseaus were not, or the motivation was not proving providing program analysis for compiler optimization, but their idea was providing static analysis of programs for program proving. So he came from a school where they tried to have proof systems to verify that the program does what it should do. And there, in that school, everything is undecidable. So you play around with logical theories, and you have to do proving, and you do long calculations, and in the end you may succeed or you may not succeed. And since everything is undecidable, it is a little bit of frustrating business. So his idea was, how can I come up with proving program properties automatically? And in some sense, this is what compilers have done before. And I guess he simply didn't know about compilers. So he came from mathematics somehow. So, but in some sense, it's the same thing. You have a program, you want to prove properties. Usually the properties which we have seen were very simple. And he came up with a framework how you can also complicated properties prove automatically about programs. And that is, and he provided the background theory for that, and that is abstract interpretation. And that theory, kind of the easiest instance or the simplest instance of that is constant propagation. And therefore I explained to you this abstract interpretation idea for the case of constant propagation. So what is now we have already the analysis how we can do constant propagation, but we are not so sure how can we convince ourselves that what we do is correct. And in order to make that in a systematic way, he came up, or one way of opposing it is, so he had some Galois connection and mathematical constructions. We do not use that here. We make a kind of, if you like, a abstract interpretation for dummies, so to speak. And I include myself into these dummies. So to cut down the mathematics and get it as handy as possible. So for that, one would simply say, we have what's going on in the real operational semantics, and then we have this, if you like, abstract semantics. And that was, in some sense, that the abstract semantics means that we evaluate the program state not with as a real state, but over the complete lattice. So that is, we have to compare the real program state with the information provided by our complete lattice, or an element, in fact, an element of the complete lattice. So in order to kind of relate these two things, we could come up with a description relation relating the world which is going on in the concrete and the world and the lattice element which is tracked by the analysis. So now this, this is just a binary relation, and we kind of ask for this relation to satisfy a minimal property, and the minimal property is that when our abstract value gets larger, then we still describe the same elements. We could describe more elements, but not less. So then this holds. So this is the intuition. When the lattice element gets larger, we get more imprecise. And more imprecise means, so for constant propagation, it was we have 5 or we have top. And top means it could be 5, but it could also be 6. So it is more, the top describes the 5 and it describes also the 6. But it still describes the 5. So when we get larger, we describe the same elements, but maybe more. And therefore, we lose information. Okay, and that kind of, that the smaller the value, the more precise the value is, that is described by this property here. Okay, and then that is in some sense everything what we have. And then we say that there is something like a concretization of an abstract element. So the top. And we can say which elements are described by top, which concrete elements are described by top. And that is very easy because it's everything. So for top, it's everything. And then we may also ask what elements are described by 5, by the abstract value 5 in this partial order. And then we say, okay, so only 5. Okay? So that is, and so the gamma of A is the set of all axes which are described by A. And so here is kind of the formal definition of what in our example, how the description relation is, how we construct it. So in essence, we need the description relation for the elements in the complete lattice. So that is for the concrete program state and these assignments of variables to abstract values. But we build up this description relation by applying it a kind of composition in a compositional way. We first say when is a concrete value described by an abstract value, then we say when is a variable assignment described by an abstract variable assignment, and then when is a program state applied by described by an abstract program state. So in these three stages we proceed. So therefore we first have this description relation for values, and that is easy. That is as I described. So if I have an A, And I wonder whether A describes a set, then they should be the same. So if it's so, this means A is also a number, or A is top. Top describes everything. And likewise, the concretization of an element A is A if it is the set consisting just of A. If A is not top, and if it is top, then everything is described. And for variable assignments, we have in the real world variable assignments here. They map variables to numbers. And we have these abstract variable assignments where we could also have the element top or even this bottom element. And now, so the first thing is, now we have two such things, one concrete variable assignment and such an element D. D from our complete lattice. And then we can say, okay, this row is only described by D if D is different from bottom. If it is bottom, then no row is described. And that is kind of our intuition, that the bottom indicates not reachable. So there is no, therefore you cannot reach it, and therefore no variable assigned. So it's the empty set. The concretization is the empty set. Okay. Now, but if there is a row, then there must be also a D, which is different from bottom, and that should have the property that for every variable X, the value kind of, we could say here, is described. Yeah, so therefore we use that here. That would be the neatest way how to describe it. And that means simply if it's 5, if row of X is 5, then D of X should be 5 or top. And then we can, then also say, if I have an element D, a capital D, which is bottom, then the concretization of it is the empty set, so it describes nothing. And if it is a variable assignment, assigning variables to numbers or top, then it describes all concrete variable assignments which have the same form and agree in the concrete values, and for top have anything. Okay, good. So that means in particular, let us make one more little stupid example. If you want to know what is the gamma of X is mapped to 5 and Y is mapped to top, then it is the set of all variable assignments row from X, Y to real values with the property row of X equals 5. No statement is made about the value of Y. It could be anything. Yeah? So that's it. All rows with that property will be described by that single variable assignment up there. Okay? So that gives us this. Here's another example of two things which are describes each other. So here, if you have this concrete variable assignment, by replacing some of the concrete values with top, you get an abstract description. And so that was for variable assignments. Now, but the concrete program state is not just a variable assignment, but also describes what is the values in the in memory. Now, our content propagation ignores the value in memory. So therefore, if you have such a program state, we kind of ignore the values in memory. That means it is described by a variable assignment if and only if the row is described by the variable assignment. And the mu is simply thrown away. And that kind of... so that is we can do technically. You can always throw away some component, but this also already explains the weakness of the analysis. Namely, whenever you write to memory and read back, you lose information. So if we kind of think that our intermediate language speaks about registers only, and not about the call stack and the dynamic data structures, then it's very limited information which we can infer. So we should not overrate that analysis. So if you want to keep track of data which are stored in dynamic data structures, then you need completely different techniques. On the other hand, if the data in dynamic data structures typically depend on input, they are user dependent, and so there is perhaps little hope to find out what really is in a dynamic data structure, because as its name says, it is dynamic, so it changes all the time. Okay. So now, how can we? So that now we have this description relation. What does it help us? So now the idea is the following: we want to prove, assume that we have a start state S, a concrete start state, and an initial description D. And this initial description describes the start state. And then we have a path. A program execution path, pi. So here is this pi. Then this pi has in the concrete world, it corresponds to a transformation of the program state, or is undefined. But assume that it is defined, that this transformation of pi is defined for S and results in an, then it transforms S into some concrete state S1. And now we would like to verify that if I replace the transformations corresponding to the concrete semantics by the transformations corresponding to the abstract semantics, then we obtain, okay, so then we obtain some D1, and the claim is, and we would like to have, that these two things are again in this description relation. So that is what we hope to be able to prove. and that in particular means, what does it mean? That means if they are in this description relation, that this means that this S1 here, this S1 is in the gamma of the D1. That means that the result state of the program, execution, is contained in the gamma of the abstract program execution applied to the abstract state. So that means that this abstract, I want to have it in red. So this thing provides us with some information about the concrete program state after execution of pi. Namely, I can do this abstract thing alone and then apply the gamma, and then I get something. So for example, if I find out that after the abstract computation x, the d has information x is mapped to 5, then I know the gamma of that state, abstract state, has also provides only program states where x is has the value 5, and therefore x has the value 5 also in the concrete execution of the program whenever I have executed pi. Okay? So therefore this so it would be therefore good that when we can once for all prove that this description relation is preserved by program execution. Now going back here, so this we claim we want to have that this holds this property holds for all pi, and that is now again a depressing thing because there are so many pi's, there are so many program executions, infinitely many perhaps. And do we want to inspect all of them? And the answer is no. We prove it once for all. What do we? How would we make a proof of such a statement? We would. Well, pi is a path which is long. So what would we do? An induction on the length of pi. And the only so in order to do that. So here is that. Yeah, that I have already explained. In order to prove that. It suffices when we provide the same commuting rectangle just for a single edge in the program. Of the why? Because when the delta is preserved for one edge k, and then I do it for the next one, and the next one, and the next one, and until I have exhausted all the pi. Yeah. So therefore, it suffices to prove that if I have one edge k, and initially the concrete and the abstract state are in this description relation, then that this description relation is preserved by going through the k, meaning that we can write it down whether this state is described by this state. Yeah? So that's the only thing which we have to prove. And I perhaps make it such a way that I write a red thing here. So. Can we prove that? And now we have only finitely many cases to look at, because there are only finitely many things which can happen at the control flow edge, and then we go through each of them and see whether this property holds. And this is now a proof which by case distinction, which is simpler than a proof by induction. So but it's not complete. So but there's one thing. There is so the knob operation is easy. Hopefully, then there is this assignment thing. We always have to think about the assignment. And then there are, sadly enough, there are more than one form of assignment because there are so many expressions. So we have to look at all these expressions. And so we might, for the as a kind of warm-up, compare, check what goes on if we evaluate an expression in the concrete and in the abstract. And now it would be nice if we could prove whenever we have a variable assignment, a concrete variable assignment rho, which is described by some d, and we evaluate the expression for rho in the concrete and for d in the abstract, that then still this description relation holds. And that is, okay, so again, this is a statement which holds for all expressions, which we have to prove for all expressions E. And again, we might be depressed since there are so many expressions. We could say, okay, in practice, all expressions have depth at most 2, but you could also do an induction. So that now we have to do an induction over the size of the expression E. And what is the base? What are the kind of steps which we have? So there's the base step when we have a constant or a variable, and these kind of steps are easy because for the variable we can apply that information. For the constants, 5 is described by 5. That's always fine. Or it's described by top if we have that in there. But it's so that is easy. The only thing is now we have to do the inductive step. That is the interesting point. And that means we have an operator application. We have already proven that the corresponding arguments are in the description relation. Now we apply an operator plus here, and we apply this plus sharp there. Would the result again be in the description relation? That is what we have to prove. So assume that the arguments are in the description relation. Is it the case that then the operator application preserves the description relation? That is the question which we have to verify for every operator which in our which we look at. Now we have to for us, this operator definition was very simple. It was we use this box sharp uses the same definition as box, and if there's top, it returns top. So definitely, therefore, this property here holds. In general, when you have other forms of abstract semantics, this property might be more complicated, or we use other this sharp operators as abstract operators, this green property might be more complicated to verify. But you could say, you could also turn the things upside down, and you say, if you do abstract interpretation of your program, you have to provide operators, box sharp, for every operator box, which satisfy this green property. And if this is the case, the rest goes through. So in some sense, that was kind of the idea of abstract interpretation, that you kind of condense all the proving effort to a minimal core of things where you have to prove something, and in essence it boils down to proving that this property holds. And then the rest is kind of always goes through. So that is... But I guess for today, the time is over, and... Next week, we then will kind of assuming, so from the green thing, we obtain that this property here holds. That for expressions, if the row is described by the D, then the evaluation of E with respect to row is described by the result of the returned by the abstract evaluation over the D. That is the start point with which we start next and see whether then the description relation is preserved by all other operations in our actions at control for edges. So for today, thank you very much for your attention, and have a nice week.